Welcome into the Ether, a podcast brought to you by ETHUB, the essential source for Ethereum information. Into the Ether features talks with prominent guests in the community, as well as weekly recaps of the ETHUB newsletter. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHUB Weekly Recap. On these episodes, we discuss the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we are discussing the news from November 11th to November 17th. Hey, Anthony, you want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric, sure. So the last 24 hours have been quite exciting for crypto with multi-collateral DAI going live. We'll talk about that a little bit later. The first things I wanted to quickly mention was the next Ethereum network upgrade, Istanbul, is going live in a couple of weeks. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out there that anyone running an Ethereum node should definitely upgrade now. I think the target date is December 7th from what I've seen. There's a website in the newsletter that I linked where you can actually track all of this. So if you go there, it allows you to track like the current status of the network, like how many nodes have upgraded. I think at the moment, I'm just loading the website now to check. Geth, there's 24% of the nodes are ready that are being tracked here, with 76% not being ready. So definitely upgrade before the time comes. I don't think this is something to worry about because this is the same thing that happens every network upgrade where people just wait until maybe a few days before and then upgrade. So not a big deal here. Istanbul is not a controversial upgrade. There are a couple of EIPs in there that people were kind of like complaining about, one of them being like the gas recosting optimizations there. But other than that, I don't think this is going to be a contentious fork. It doesn't actually include ProgPal. ProgPal might be included in the next network upgrade, which is in another few months. But yeah, definitely just go upgrade your node if you're running one to make sure you're running the correct version when the kind of hard fork occurs on December 7th. And the other thing I want to talk about was the blog post that you wrote last week, Eric. So this blog post was like the ultimate guide to ENS. So it basically covered everything with the Ethereum name service, like how to get set up and, you know, how to set up like things like subdomains, and what it actually is. Did you want to walk through like what this kind of post did in detail?
Yeah, sure. I guess it was kind of stemmed by me exploring the ENS. I obviously was like kind of talking and tweeting a lot about it in the last few weeks, and it was kind of stemmed from the fact that the documentation was just spread everywhere across Medium. I think this is a pretty common occurrence in Ethereum in general, but you like Google something, there's either some random Medium post from 2 years ago, or there's some like Twitter threads you have to piece together. And so finally I was like, and the ENS does have like a documentation section, but it's more like on the technical side, right? It's not like, hey, here's A to Z, like all the cool things you can do with the ENS and how to set it up. So decided to just kind of take it upon myself when I was, exploring and doing some things with it over the last couple of weeks. So yeah, I mean, on the most basic level, it just tells you, first, like what the ENS is and what you can do with it, but registering a name and then tying an Ethereum address to that name so that if you type like eric.eth into MetaMask, it resolves to my address. And then it goes into, how to transfer ownership of that name, how to buy names on the secondary market. And then where things start to get really interesting to me, at least, is this concept of subdomains, right? So you can create as many subdomains as you would like, although the names themselves have to be unique. So if I create like eric.ismoney.eth, which is some subdomains I'm kind of playing around with for fun, but if you were to create that, no one else can have that exact subdomain. But I kind of walk through the different ways you can offer up subdomains, and one of the coolest things is you can turn them over to, you can transfer ownership to a smart contract, which then allows you to sell subdomains. So one thing I've been messing around, like I said, is I own ismoney.eth, so I turned the ownership over to this subdomain registrar contract that I believe Nick Johnson created. And now on a site, I can host something that sells subdomains on there, right? So just kind of fun to experiment with. And I know some people have gone through the guide and completely like bought a domain, turned over to the subdomain register, hosted a site, and are selling their own subdomains now. So just pretty cool. I'm super bullish on the ENS. I obviously would always exercise caution. If you're advertising your ENS name out there, make sure it's on a clean address that even if funds come in, you like cycle your coins through an exchange or a mixer or something like that before you send them to another. Don't link these to, you know, your main accounts where people can see your entire Ethereum history. But I think the ENS is going to do a lot of good for UX in general in Ethereum, and a lot of cool hacks came out at ETH Waterloo using it as well. And I think the next step, just kind of with all this stuff, is we need good privacy solutions. But definitely suggest go, if you haven't played with the ENS, go just Google the ultimate guide to the ENS. I'm guessing it comes up near the top, and go play around with it.
Yeah, I guess that was one of the chief concerns around ENS was privacy, right? And like, I guess people really need to be aware of this. I did put out a warning when I said that, like, I encourage people to put their ENS name in their Twitter name to kind of encourage adoption for ENS. But I did warn people that if they do this, then that address will be public and that every transaction on there will, you know, be able to be seen by everyone forever, since it's, you know, in the on the Ethereum blockchain. So definitely don't make public any ENS you don't want known. Ethereum's getting privacy, it'll get it eventually, but it's still pretty far away, I think, from being usable by everyday users. And then even then, there's limitations to that, those privacy implementations. So yeah, I guess like my ENS Sasol.eth, what I did was I just cycled coins through Binance, and then, you know, that withdrew the ETH to my ENS address, so didn't link back to my other accounts. Because yeah, if you screw up once where you have one transaction going from your ENS account to your other accounts you don't want people to know about, it's there forever and there's no way to revoke that, unfortunately. Unless, I guess, you control 51% of the Ethereum network, but then I think we have more to worry about than a few ENS names being linked.
Right, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think it's a good highlight on the privacy issues in general. A lot of people were kind of freaking out and almost like blaming the ENS for having a privacy issue, and that's not true, right? Ethereum has a privacy issue. Bitcoin has a privacy issue. Most public blockchains have a big privacy issue. So, you know, hopefully with ENS gaining adoption and people starting to realize this more and more, it potentially accelerates some privacy solutions out there, at least gains them a little bit more interest from the community. But you know, that it's no different than giving your address out to someone and having them pay you, and then that address could be tied to other addresses you own too, right? It makes it a little bit more real, I think. Like, it visualizes the privacy issues that we have.
Yeah, exactly. Totally agree. I guess we'll see what happens in the next few months with privacy. I think there's a few solutions coming online. They're getting cheaper with the new Istanbul EIPs, so we'll keep an eye on that for sure. All right, moving on to the news of the week. So this was some news that I included in the newsletter. I kind of debated whether to include it or not because it was more of a rumor than news. And it actually came out today that this ended up being a rumor, an actual rumor, and actually wasn't true at all, really. But the news was that Canada's biggest bank might launch a crypto exchange, essentially. Now, this is interesting because it actually wasn't too far-fetched, because I kind of see this blurring of traditional finance with, you know, crypto finance happening at a rapid pace. We already have institutions like the owner of the New York Stock Exchange launching Bakkt, which is kind of like a Bitcoin futures trading platform. We had the CME get involved with Bitcoin futures back in late 2017. And we have, like, I guess, slow institutional adoption happening where these old players, or old money as it's referred to, is blurring with the kind of the new money. So I didn't think this is that far-fetched that, you know, Canada's bank would launch a crypto exchange. But I think, yeah, it came out today that this was actually, you know, a rumor. They've denied it. I mean, the rumor was based on patents that the bank had filed around this sort of stuff. And, you know, them coming out and denying it. I mean, I guess, like, they could be denying it just to save face, and maybe they just didn't want this out in the open. But yeah, for now, I think that it's not happening, obviously, and they don't want to have their plans public. But I guess we'll see going forward if other banks take this on board too and get involved with crypto. They might not be able to as well for regulatory reasons. They might have to spin off different arms and do it that way. They might have to acquire something, like maybe Coinbase gets acquired one day by one of the bigger banks, because Coinbase is essentially a crypto bank at this stage, along with a few of the other exchanges as well. They're offering not just trading services, but, you know, obviously custody services, staking services, things like that. So definitely think that we might see a bank, maybe whether it's a big bank or a small bank or whatever, acquire an exchange. Maybe they don't acquire Coinbase, maybe they acquire one of the smaller exchanges. But in my mind, it's definitely leaving money on the table by not doing this, especially because I guess like banks traditionally don't like people, you know, interacting with crypto exchanges because it's been linked to like money laundering and things like that, which I think is just a bullshit excuse anyway. But regardless of that, maybe them spinning up their own exchange allows them to, I guess, funnel these users who they would rather not do things with crypto exchanges into their own platform so they could profit off of it. So I guess we'll see what shakes out there. But yeah, Eric, did you get a chance to have a look at this and kind of had some thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think, you know, just speaking generally here, since this they ended up kind of denying this news, but I think one of the big things we're going to see in the next, you know, crypto bubble, whether that comes tomorrow or in 500 years from now, is going to be more traditional services hopping on and offering crypto trading. My hunch is that near the peak of the last bubble, a lot of them were probably caught off guard a little bit and then started gearing up ideas internally of how to capture this market. Because the reality is, you know, all banks these days are pretty squeezed for margin and profits, and they're going to be looking for any opportunity they can get to add to that. Now, you know, when crypto's sitting here and trading volumes are a little low and prices are way off the highs and there's not as much interest in the retail space, I don't think that's going to be a time that banks hop in. They're probably going to be hopping in, you know, as the interest starts to build up again. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a lot of them kind of have plans internally to kick that into motion, but are just a bit in a waiting pattern. And then obviously in a hold when it comes to regulations too, which is something you tapped on. I don't think, you know, at least in the U.S., banking regulators aren't going to be too keen to just letting a bank, you know, start to launch crypto trading without having some type of oversight, right? But I think it's going to start in the U.S. with people like TD, E-Trade, like these more traditional brokerage services. They're going to start offering it alongside, you know, your traditional stock trading and 401k and IRA type trading. And it's going to kind of go from there, right? I think that's at least in the U.S. where it's going to start. But there's no way that these service providers and these banks are going to miss out on another bull run where exchanges are taking in millions, you know, like potentially billions in trading volume, depending on like how crazy the market gets and how many users come into the space. So again, I wouldn't be surprised if there's plans behind the scenes for someone like RBC to launch this and they just are kind of denying it for now. But I think this will be a really interesting trend to keep an eye on. And in my opinion, it's kind of like the next big step we need to take to get outside of just the users that are kind of just in crypto today, right? I know a lot of people personally that are still scared to use, you know, more conservative investors or maybe older investors that are still scared to use Coinbase, right? Like, we think it's fine and safe and trusted and we all use it, but there's a lot of people out there that, you know, are basically waiting for their brokerage service to offer stuff like this.
Yeah, exactly. I can see that definitely being true. And especially, yeah, I guess we discussed this last time, how this is kind of like a young person's game where they're like, you know, crypto natives, they're internet natives. They kind of put trust in these things a lot quicker than maybe the people who didn't kind of grow up with this stuff do. And they're maybe waiting for, as you said, the traditional finance counterparts to come on board, which, you know, unfortunately for them might be a bad idea, because by that point, I mean, they'll probably be buying into the bubble. All right, moving on to project updates. So I guess the biggest news, we have to talk about it. Multicollateral DAI went live. So it went live at 4 p.m. UTC, about an hour after I sent the newsletter out. I think this is a very historic moment for, like, I guess, open finance, Ethereum, DeFi, the whole thing. This represents years of work. Like, I think it's like 5 years worth of work to get to this point. Single collateral DAI was kind of like the MVP, and MCD was the goal, kind of like ETH1 is the MVP and ETH2 is the goal. So I think that's good to keep in mind that this wasn't something that was just thought of later. It was actually there from the beginning. So some people are saying that this is like a forced upgrade and, you know, it shouldn't be happening like this centrally or whatever, but it kind of isn't. Like, there was that social contract there that basically said that we're going to go to multicollateral DAI. If you use DAI today or if you open a CDP, you will be required to migrate. I think people got kind of like annoyed about the name changes as well. Like, the single collateral DAI becoming SAI, MCD having DAI, and then changing the names from CDPs to vaults and things like that. I do think there's probably some legal and regulatory stuff in the mix there about the naming schemes of things, because Maker is a US-based company. They operate heavily in the US. You know, the MKR token is probably security, so they're probably stepping, you know, around regulations and laws and trying to follow them as best as possible, as not to put a target on their back, especially because they're the biggest kind of DeFi platform out there, right? But I guess, like, enough on that. You know, MCD is live. I think there's like 3 million DAI has been migrated across so far. People have opened a bunch of CDPs with the only other token available right now, which is BATS, the Basic Attention Token. The debt ceiling for that's like 3 million DAI. So that's already been tapped out because it's so low. People just don't really have anything else to do with their BAT if they're holding it. I guess like the whole use case of BAT is to tip on, you know, using the Brave browser to tip different people for their content. But I think most of people are just using it to speculate. So that was, you know, that tapped out pretty fast. I think even just a couple of hours after MCD went live. But yeah, so the migration process will last quite a while. There's no hard date for when single collateral DAI will be kind of like emergency shut down or globally settled. There's a soft kind of timeline of 6 months, but I guess we can reevaluate in 6 months if it's the right time to do it or if people need to migrate across. A bunch of projects already put out their migration process for multicollateral DAI. I think the Maker Twitter account retweeted pretty much all of it, all of the people, you know, all of the companies discussing this and putting out blog posts around it. So definitely go check out that if you're curious. A quick plug there, Set will be putting out something in the next few weeks about the migration process. So keep an eye out for that if you hold any sets on token sets. But yeah, I guess like the killer app here, besides the multicollateral part of MCD, is the DAI savings rate. I know this is something that you're really bullish on as well, Eric, where you can basically lock up your DAI and you earn like a small amount of interest on it. So it's like a low risk savings account. I think it's currently set at 2% a year, which is obviously lower than the other platforms like Compound, which give you 4-5% currently. But it's definitely a lot less risky than something like that. There's no liquidity risk because there's no borrower on the other side. It's literally just locking up your DAI and the interest is paid out of the stability fees that that are paid by CDP holders or vault holders. Sorry, got to start using the new terminology. But yeah, definitely I'd like to hear your thoughts around this, Eric, especially the DSR, because you've been saying to me for a while, like, I think you've been quite bearish on multicollateral DAI, like the multicollateral part, and you've been quite public about this, but the DSR is something you're definitely bullish about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been, DAI savings rate's been, well, I guess this whole system has been talked about and theorized for like 5 years now, right? Like the original idea for Maker from Rune and all that was this concept of multicollateral DAI. So I guess first, it's really cool to see come to fruition, right? Like to watch the entire process happen was neat and watch the governance take place and it cast on the mainnet. And I definitely agree with you. This was part of a social contract if you were a DAI, a single collateral DAI holder, right? Like the Maker team has been very clear that this is the roadmap, this is the plan. It's been like that for years. So I definitely don't understand people complaining about this upgrade, right? Like I think you put it well there. I definitely agree with that aspect. You know, it's interesting to watch this play out. I feel like how is this process going to look in say like 15 years, right? When there's a lot more people on the network and a lot more DAI out there and not even just using Maker. Like this is probably the final version of this system, but like another DeFi system that has to go through a major upgrade and has lots of users. Like it's a pretty cumbersome process to inform everybody and stuff. So to watch this play out in the future and in other protocols, or maybe who knows, Maker again someday, will be interesting because as time goes on, this for sure gets more complex. But I guess first, huge congrats to the Maker team for putting this out. And if you want to see a cool dashboard of like all the stats that are happening, like go to daistats.com. It kind of has everything from like how much ETH locked and the total DAI generated. We're sitting at like 2.5 million DAI generated right now. So that's pretty quick for the first day. But yeah, I think you summed up my feelings pretty well. I'm not that bullish on the multicollateral part, which is fine. Not everybody in this ecosystem has to agree with everybody else. I still think that just using ETH as collateral, this platform could have gone very far and been less risky, in my opinion. But the DAI savings rate is for sure something I'm excited about. And it's something been talked about for a while. And you basically summed it up. But yeah, the stability fee essentially, or part of it, gets passed on to people that are locking up their DAI and earning this rate. So I think the stability fee right now on the ETH side of multicollateral DAI is like 4%. And the DAI savings rate is 2%. So part of that stability fee is getting passed passed over to people that are locking up their DAI. And, you know, you put it well too, like the important thing is here, there's not like a borrower on the other side of this, like you would see in like a peer-to-peer borrowing or like a compound or something. So definitely a lot of interesting new dynamics at play here, but just kind of cool that, you know, if you have DAI, you can just go lock it up now in the system and earn an interest rate. And it really helps balance the supply and demand of this as well, right? So obviously if this rate goes up, that means stability fees are going up and you're going to get more DAI locked in the system earning and vice versa on the other way. But I still don't, yeah, I don't want to rant too much, but the terminology of vault, I don't know about that one. Like it's misleading is potentially the wrong word. Like I get the terminology to an extent, but I worry that we're not as a community being completely honest about the risk of these vaults or what were called CDPs in the past. I think some people learned some tough lessons during the bear market and what can actually happen in a margin position and getting liquidated, and calling these vaults, you know, at least when I think of a vault, I don't think that I could potentially reopen it and all my money would be gone one day, right? So I think definitely some weird terminology there, but potentially that's just nitpicking at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of the vault terminology either. It doesn't really make much sense for what a CDP is. Like as you said, you don't expect you to reopen the vault and then see that all your money is gone. And I also don't think of like a CDP as something that you kind of like, it's not closed when you have it like open. You don't go back and open it up. It's like open until you close it sort of thing. So yeah, the terminology is weird there as well. But I guess like for whatever reason they did it for, I'm erring on the side that they did it for legal reasons, just because I can see how much tiptoeing they have to do with the legal and regulatory stuff. And I can see like obviously most of the community didn't really like the terminology, so it's kind of stupid for them to use that terminology, you know, if they weren't forced into using it. So definitely something to think about in the future, and maybe for all these other projects as well. I would not attribute them just being silly or you know, doing silly things and making mistakes unless they're kind of like forced to, because a lot of these DeFi stuff, especially the American or the US-based companies, really need to be very careful with how they do things because of legal and regulatory stuff. Like this is a massive gray area. No one really knows what the response is going to be from different things. Like, you know, you can imagine one day that Maker gets really, really big and, you know, there's a massive crash and like all these positions get liquidated and there's a bunch of people that launch a class action lawsuit against Maker or something. You know, sounds silly, but it might happen. And then, you know, there needs to be like a kind of a Maker that isn't there to be sued or, you know, for there to be a class action filed against. So I think that's why they're trying to decentralize this stuff as well. But definitely something to keep in mind.
Yeah, what's neat is they've now combined a lot of features in their Oasis app. So now they have like trading, borrowing, and saving all in one place, which is pretty cool. Like in the past, they had like the Oasis trading. And then, of course, they didn't have the saving because they didn't have the DAI savings rate. But then they had like the CDP portal. So it's kind of neat if you go to oasis.app, everything's all in one now. I think it makes that a lot more coherent to people and kind of helps you, you know, piece the system together. So, you know, I don't know about you personally. I'm not rushing to lock my Ether in a contract that's been live for less than 24 hours, but there's 35,000 ETH already locked in this thing, which I don't know. I guess it surprises me a little. People are so willing to just rush and not worry about a bug. But anyways, yeah, hopefully these things are nice and secure, just like the first ones.
Yeah, we were having this discussion kind of, I guess, like a few hours ago, where we were talking about like what can we do to make to have a metric that tracks like security of these contracts. And you put a tweet out about, you know, depending on how much value is locked, you know, over time. So if like 1 million ETH, not 1 million ETH, but like $1 million worth of ETH was locked a long time ago, rather than $1 million worth of ETH being locked now, that would account for more because the contract's like older and might have had more eyes on it. And, you know, there's like a kind of like a bug bounty on that contract saying, hey, like there's all this money locked in here, come and steal me sort of thing. I kind of disagree with you on that because I've worked in cybersecurity and I know that like measuring kind of like security based on how much value is locked is probably not the best metric, because I don't think many people actually do their due diligence on the contracts. Like, most people can't actually vet the contract themselves. No one, like most people, like pretty much 99.99% of people have no idea how to like hack a contract. There are like really good kind of hackers out there that can find exploits in different parts of code. And, you know, these exploits can go unnoticed for years by the best professionals. And then you have someone that comes along and might just quickly crack it on their own because they're better than the others, or maybe they saw something that the others didn't. And, you know, it doesn't matter if there's like billions of dollars being locked in there for years at that point, right? You know, the contract has been a success until that point, but then all of a sudden, you know, someone finds a bug and steals all the money. and then I guess we kind of talked about, you know, second order effects of this, where, you know, if there was $1 billion worth of ETH locked in the Maker contract and someone stole it all, that address that they withdrew that ETH to would be blacklisted by like all these major exchanges pretty much instantly. It'd be very hard to cash out $1 billion worth of ETH. You'd probably crash the ETH price just because of all the uncertainty and FUD around it in general. You know, that amount of money being stolen could probably lead to law enforcement getting involved as well. So you'd have to hide your tracks very carefully. There's a lot to it, more to it, I think, than just the value lock thing. But I think your idea for that metric was good in kind of aggregate. So having it as just one kind of metric in the tool set of measuring the risk of these sorts of things, kind of like, I guess, what like the DeFi score from Consensus is trying to do. But yeah, I thought that was like maybe just one more metric we could use, but obviously not the be all and end all.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of a metric in the scheme of things. And obviously these things are never going to be pure zero risk, right? There's always a non-zero chance that these are going to be hacked, even if the contract's been out there, you know, 1,000 years and has had, you know, trillions of dollars locked in it. There's still a chance, yeah, someone's going to come along and find something. I do think this is something the community in general should focus a bit more on. Yeah, maybe this DeFi score effort, it will help with that. Creating like new metrics as indicators could help with that. But yeah, just in general, I guess I'm not one to rush out and just start dumping all my ETH into a contract hot off the presses.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great approach. I think, with Maker, they have more reputation than something that was just brand new. So that might be why people are doing it now. But we'll see, I guess, into the future. I think we've spoken enough about it for now. We'll see how the migration goes over the next few months. I'm pretty excited to see it. You know, keep going smoothly and see what happens with MCD in general. All right, on to the next thing. So Compound, so more DeFi news. They raised $25 million in a Series A last week. That is a huge amount of money for a Series A, but not kind of surprising to me because of the fact that they are one of the biggest DeFi apps, right? They are, I guess, at number three now behind Synthetics, but like there was a bit of drama about how to value kind of like USD locked for kind of something like Synthetics, something like Compound and Maker, but we won't get into that. That was hashed out on Twitter quite a bit last week. But yeah, so they raised $25 million. They actually stated that they don't really have a business model yet of like how to monetize Compound. I think they're making money off like taking a little bit of a fee from the borrowers when people borrow from Compound. And they've got other ways they can make money in that respect as well. A few people thought, you know, maybe they're going to launch a token eventually, which kind of makes sense given that their investors included included kind of companies that normally do like investing in projects that have tokens. So I think there was A16Z was in there, like the usual suspects, A16Z, Paradigm Investor, Bain Capital and Polychain Capital kind of led the round. So I think that Compound may actually issue a token eventually. I don't think it's going to be a shoehorned in token. I do think that these decentralized networks, if they want to be decentralized, they kind of need to become like a network rather than a central company operating it. And to do that, you need some kind of incentive for people to participate in these networks and to steward it and to kind of like upgrade it through either a governance process or like kind of like what MKR token is used for, right? And like what Synthetics is doing with SNX, like having the token deeply ingrained into the platform. I think that a token can be very good in these circumstances. I think that something like a utility token where it would require the user to purchase this token to use the platform is just like fundamentally flawed. And those sorts of things won't accrue value and will be kind of like pushed out of the market. And those projects will probably have to get rid of their token. So I don't think them, like if they do issue a token, I don't think it's going to be like a bearish thing for kind of DeFi in general. I know that some people think it would be, but I'm not convinced that it would be. I think that their token would obviously be a security, so it would drive value to it. There'd be more alignment between participants on Compound rather than just people that lending and borrowing, but also people that are kind of stewarding the network, whether it's voting on what assets to add, voting on the different parameters for these assets, kind of like what you do with multicollateral DAI. So congrats on the raise anyway to the team. This is going to give them a long runway. $25 million goes a long way. They're going to keep growing, I think, because lending is an extremely hot market in crypto. Even if the rates are low, it's still very hot because people just want to get more assets so they can go long on these crypto assets like ETH and BTC. Because, you know, even if you're paying a 20% a year kind of like borrow rate, ETH and BTC can move more than that and like a lot more than that, right? And obviously wipe out the fees quite quickly so you can begin profiting off of that. So I think that's why something like Maker as well got very popular. Obviously, a lot of people going long on ETH with extra leverage there. So we'll see what Compound does. I mean, with this amount of money, I think they can introduce a lot more features a lot more quickly. I think they're going to evolve into like Compound V3. I think they already evolved to V2 with C tokens, but I'd like to see what a V3 looks like, whether that includes a token or not.
Yeah, this is really cool to see. I mean, obviously, big fans of Compound and the team in general. And, you know, I've talked to Robert a decent amount in the past, and he's been on the podcast. So huge congrats to them and well deserved. It's kind of cool. I remember when the white paper came out, and I was like, wow, this is a pretty cool idea. And I think at the time, Coinbase was an original investor and stuff. And that was before the app was even launched. And then to watch it go from there to the app being live and through V1 to V2. And now this, they kind of, I would say, kickstarted the idea of programmable interest with CDAI. I mean, the idea's obviously been out there, but it really kind of caught wildfire after they put it in version 2 with CDAI. So definitely well deserved. And yeah, I guess this is news to me that Compound takes the fees. I was reading some of these fees and or feeds on Twitter about this, and I know people were kind of, a couple of people hopped in and said, yeah, you guys know that Compound takes a fee on the borrowings, right? And I actually didn't know this. It's kind of hard to find this. Admittedly, after we record this, I'm going to go read through the white paper, which I couldn't find it in like directly by just doing a search. I don't remember reading about this. Maybe it snuck into V2. I truly don't know. But anyways, I'm going to go dig into this. And this kind of, if that's true, this perfectly plays into my theory. I've actually talked to you a lot about this offline, and I've tweeted about in the past too. I wish more projects would just put a fee into their system to help pay for things, right? I think the community in general is very fearful that if you put any type of fee in open source software, someone's going to come and just fork it out and launch it with no fee. And I actually strongly disagree with that. And I think the prime example of that would be if Compound was kind of living and being one of the most popular applications on Ethereum, and pretty much no one has realized that they're taking a fee on the borrowing side, potentially other than the borrowers themselves, right? But I think I'd seen a tweet or two from Mateo Leibowitz from The Block about this in the past, so I'm going to have to go dive into this. But do you know much detail around the fee, or are you similar to me on this?
Yeah, definitely similar to you on this. It was kind of like news to me. I saw it on Twitter as well. I haven't actually dug into it myself. But I mean, if they are taking a fee, then yeah, it's not common knowledge. And I don't think that it actually proves the thesis that having a fee in your protocol is not going to get you forked away straight away. Like, I think that you've talked about this a lot, is that you think that projects shouldn't be scared to add these fees because, I mean, like, if you have a really good product, no one's going to care about paying a small fee to use it, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my thesis. And the prime example of this too back in the day was Ether Delta. They were taking a 0.3% fee on every trade, but first of all, people didn't care because it was during the boom and everybody was trading these tokens, right? But I don't think many people knew. Like, the founder that was making a lot of money off fees, and yeah, anybody, that was a very forkable product, right? Anybody could have just forked that. I think the UI was open source. Like, they didn't really, I guess they had a network effect a bit around like the order books, but yeah, in general, I think projects should not be fearful of doing this. And potentially this plays into this this raise amount too, right? Like, maybe they're actually making a decent amount off this. Maybe they're not, I don't know, but it's time to go dive into it for sure.
Yeah, I remember that as well. I think Ether Delta did get forked into Fork Delta, but only when they when Ether Delta was bought by a separate entity, and then they wanted to shoehorn a token in. So there's that bit of anecdotal evidence for Compound if they issue a token. Hopefully they don't get forked down, and you know, Compound, the fork version overtakes Compound, the non-forked version. I don't see that happening. It's a different kind of game now. I think Ether Delta was just like one or two people running it, whereas Compound's this whole team, and you know, it's backed by all these major investors, and you know, it's like the darling of DeFi. So I don't really think that's going to happen. But yeah, something to keep an eye on. All right, last thing I want to talk about was something really funny that came out of UMA protocol. So UMA is like this kind of synthetics issuance protocol where you can, you know, basically issue synthetic assets for anything, and like they mean anything because they issued a synthetic asset for poop sightings in San Francisco. So obviously they called this thing a shitcoin because that makes the most sense. But basically it's an ERC-20 token that tracks poop sightings in San Francisco. So the more, you know, poop that's sighted, the more kind of like, I think the, like, I don't know if the token price goes higher based on like the more poop that's sighted. I think it works the other way. So that like the kind of the logic is that basically the, it encourages the kind of the city to clean it up because at the moment, San Francisco has like a huge homeless problem where there's like lots of poop on the streets. Like I went to San Francisco recently and I was actually taken aback by how bad the homeless problem is. I didn't see much poop on the ground. I wasn't really looking. But yeah, the homeless problem is like huge. So the logic behind this is basically to encourage the city to clean up the kind of like the poop by issuing shit coins and selling them to residents. If the city succeeds and like the shit signings go down, then they make money. And you know, the residents could buy these coins as kind of like an emotional hedge. So if the problem gets worse, they make more money on this. So I guess it's a cool mechanism. It's obviously something that can be very gamed, I think. The obvious thing was that, oh, well, someone is just going to go take a bunch of shits in the city and like make the shit sightings kind of like skyrocket here, which means the price of the token would go up. But they responded to this saying that, you know, doing that's a bit, you know, harder in practice where, you know, if you're an everyday person and, you know, you go shit on the street, then like you suffer from the fact that you'll probably get caught doing it. And then, you know, if you get charged with it, it's very public, you know, things like that, especially if you're a public figure or something, or, you know, it's just embarrassing, right, at the end of the day to do something like this. But I wouldn't put it past people to kind of maybe go around and, man, I mean, this is just going to the dark edges of like what you can do with this sort of stuff, but I wouldn't put it past people to pay homeless people to go and like, you know, shit in very obvious places in order to increase the sightings as well. So definitely saying that can be gamed very easily, I think. But at the same time, it kind of, you know, shows the power of something like UMA in terms of like issuing a synthetic for anything on like a neutral platform like Ethereum where no one can shut this down. And it could like potentially align incentives around getting the city to clean this up. You know, and you know, in this way they make money and the residents make money depending on how it goes. So it kind of like is a bet on if you trust the government enough, because I've seen a lot of tweets about people that live in San Francisco not really trusting the local government. The Californian state government to actually do anything about this. I know you live in California as well, Eric, so I'd like to hear your take on this. But yeah, I thought it was a really cool idea. Hart Lambert, the co-founder of UMA, did a thread on this. If you want to go learn more, it's linked in the newsletter.
Yeah, I'm just sitting over here. How many times you just said poop and shit in the last 5 minutes? I would say this is a first and potentially a last for us to talk about poop on Into the Ether, but just laughing how you're switching between the two and how you determine to do that. But it's a huge... So first of all, this is like a great... We need more... like. People listening to this that don't know about UMA and synthetics are probably thinking like, what the fuck are you guys talking about? But I think that Ethereum needs more, like the applications on it need more attempts at viral marketing like this, right? Like this thing actually went pretty viral. Like it didn't knock into the mainstream, but like I think it could have, right? Like if the news would have picked up, hey, like you can get paid or the government can get paid to clean up this problem that we have in San Francisco, right? And like people love making money off anything. So this had the potential to go viral, and it's a pretty good marketing campaign for them. And yeah, I mean, this is a huge issue in California, and it's only getting worse. It's San Fran's probably worse than LA, just because LA is more spread out, so you don't see this as much. But I guess it's besides the fact. But I would be very I mean, it would be a dream come true if Ethereum and something built on it could solve problems like this, right? And it does come into just the general idea of incentivization too on Ethereum, right? Like there's just endless possibilities you can do with stuff. But when it comes to synthetics, I think in general this is becoming a pretty hot thing on Ethereum. It seems to me that the synthetics in general, the concepts of this, is gonna probably be the next big wave in DeFi. I think I've become convinced of that at this point. The ability to just collateralize and create, you know, bets, essentially, as I would put it, on pretty much anything is powerful. And, you know, synthetics themselves, we've had Kane on the podcast, they're pretty hot lately too. So be interested to see, I guess, not only where this campaign goes, but the other stuff, you know, UMA, is it UMA or UMA? I don't even know how to say it, to be honest, but they've got a strong team, and highly suggest go read the white paper and kind of understand this concept a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's UMA or UMA. I'm just going to say UMA. I don't know why. It's just what I've been saying. So I'll continue to do that. But yeah, I kind of echo your thoughts there. Synthetics is going to be huge. Like, not synthetics, the project. Synthetics in general is going to be massive. And I think UMA and synthetics, the project, are perfectly positioned to take advantage of this. Obviously, synthetics is extremely hot right now because the SNX token has kind of gone up a lot in the last few months. But like, regardless of that, their project is really great. And we did a podcast with Kane a few weeks ago. So definitely go have a listen to that if you want to learn more about that project. And yeah, go read the UMA white paper. All right. Last thing I wanted to talk about was a tweet thread from Chris Bernisky. Now, I really like these threads because Chris, in my mind, is one of the only, I mean, he's got a huge following, right? And there's not many people that have a huge following that are into Ethereum and ETH. And they kind of like pander to the Bitcoiners a lot and to like BTC as an asset. But Chris takes the other side here, and he actually speaks about ETH a lot and monitors like the progress in ETH. He's also a big fan of Decred as well. So this thread, basically, he basically talked about kind of like what the store of value assets are going to actually bring to the space and what their use case is going to ossify around. So he spoke about like BTC, DCR, and ETH in this context. And he basically said that they're going to be way more widely used as collateral than a means of exchange. And this is true, right? We already see this with ETH. Like, ETH is used as collateral in DeFi, and there's over 2 million ETH locked. I think it's 2.5 million ETH locked now. Whereas the medium of exchange for Ethereum is basically DAI or USDC or some other stablecoin. And it makes total sense. Like, no one's going to use ETH like as good money. Like, ETH is money, but it's not good money because it's not stable at the end of the day, right? And it's not accepted at a lot of places, blah, blah, blah. But something like DAI is relatively stable, USDC as well, but I guess USDC has its own issues, and, you know, DAI does as well. But basically, this thread runs through how these store of value assets are going to be, you know, more collateral than means of exchange. So, you know, it's not a long thread. I think it's like 7 or 9 tweets in it. So go check it out. It's linked in the newsletter. But I really do like that in the last tweet, he said, under the world's current financial and psychological frameworks, it would make BTC much closer to gold and ETH much closer to money, just with how kind of like these assets are being used. Because he justifies that by saying that the collateral economy around ETH allows ETH to be as a store of value, but also to extend its utility beyond that to become like a medium exchange in the future as well, much more than BTC, especially I think because BTC is deflationary, whereas ETH is inflationary, where in ETH 2 will settle on kind of like a really low perpetual issuance rate, whereas with Bitcoin, in the deflationary nature of it means that it's going to be volatile for quite a while, probably like decades, if not, I mean, hundreds of years is kind of hard to grasp there, but, you know, for quite a while. So yeah, go read this thread to get more context around kind of like what I'm talking about here. It's a bit hard to talk about everything in the thread. There was kind of replies to this saying that BTC is already being used a lot more as collateral than ETH because of something like BitMEX or Deribit, where it's used as collateral for these positions. But those are centralized exchanges. I think the main point here is that ETH's kind of like decentralized first, kind of DeFi on-chain collateral mechanisms is worth a lot more than what Bitcoin is doing in my mind, because that's the goal. Like, I don't want the goal to be, you know, centralized exchanges becoming these network of crypto banks that just reinvent the old system. I want to reinvent the whole financial system in a decentralized way, as decentralized as we can get it, in an open way where kind of no one is stopped from using them, and you know, no one can stop you from using them. So yeah, I think that plays into, you know, what Chris is talking about here in terms of like store of value assets. I think BTC and ETH lead here. I'm not so sure about DCR, like Decred. I mean, Decred's interesting from like a project perspective, but I haven't really seen any, you know, uptick there. But yeah, I'm curious what you thought about this one, Eric.
Yeah, I always enjoy Chris's thoughts and threads, and I agree with you. He's one of the people that kind of takes a pretty level head view on both Bitcoin and Ether, which is nice to see, at least from someone that has, you know, pretty big reach and influence. Usually, you know, I guess as far as like large Twitter followings go, most people are on the Bitcoin side. So it's nice to see kind of both sides being talked about here. But yeah, I think that last point is the most interesting. And this is something, you know, I even said when I was on the POV Crypto podcast the other day and said it to Christian, but I'm fine with Bitcoin having the digital gold narrative. Like, gold to me is boring. Yeah, the market cap's pretty big, but it's not like in the scheme of, you know, moneyness or like the entire financial system, it's not that big, right? So I'm totally fine with Bitcoin having the digital gold narrative, because I just don't find that interesting. And I think there's a cap on that narrative of how big it can be. So it's definitely, you know, pretty cool to see Chris, you know, think that, well, he wasn't really saying what I'm saying now, but he was saying Bitcoin's closer to gold and ETH's closer to money, which is something I'm a fan of, and I'm kind of hoping that things shake out to be, right? So yeah, I suggest people go read this thread. I mean, this is definitely one of the things, you know, the reason I wasn't a fan of multi-collateral DAI is I think ETH is stronger if it's the primary collateral type inside of the Ethereum ecosystem. I'm not a huge fan of, I am interested in like off-chain assets coming on, because I think in the long term, to capture, you know, the financial system and like a lot of the value that's there in the traditional side, we're gonna need real world assets coming on chain. That's a whole conversation in its own. But as far as like tokens on chain, I think it would be best if like ETH just used for collateral. Even when it comes to like Bitcoin, things like these bridges of bringing Bitcoin over to Ether, I'm torn on that. Like, I think just in the long run, we'll be fine just using ETH as collateral. And that's kind of what he's saying here as well. So definitely suggest people go check this out and just follow Chris in general, because he's got a lot of good thoughts on things.
Yeah, I think, yeah, obviously ETH's the best collateral we have on Ethereum because it's completely trustless, and it's the only really kind of native asset to Ethereum at the protocol level, right? And it's going to remain that way, you know, indefinitely, unless, you know, the whole community votes to change that. But I don't see that happening. And, you know, there's talk of bringing BTC over to Ethereum in a more decentralized way. I mean, obviously we have wrapped Bitcoin right now, but that's kind of completely centralized. I don't know if we're ever going to get to a point where we have like a decentralized BTC on Ethereum where, you know, no one can kind of like, I mean, that where you have the same security guarantees as you would on the Bitcoin network itself. And I think that's kind of bullish for ETH that we can't get that, because then people that don't even want to use ETH but still want to get exposure to these DeFi apps will be forced to use ETH and buy ETH, which I think is really great, because I think the only reason not to use ETH is maybe tribalistic, or maybe you just obviously don't want to sell your BTC or something, but you still want to use these DeFi apps, which I think is fine. But I just don't think we're going to reach that point where BTC becomes kind of on the same level as kind of trustlessness as ETH does on the Ethereum network, because I think ETH has like that very special privilege in that it's going to be the only token used for staking, and it's going to be the only token used for paying fees. Those two core uses right there are kind of indefinite, and I think that's going to lend itself to it being used as the dominant collateral for the foreseeable future. All right, that's it, everyone. Thank you for listening this week. If you haven't subscribed yet, be sure to go to ethhub.substack.com. We'll catch you in the next one. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Into the Ether. You can subscribe to the podcast and newsletter at ethub.substack.com, find our website at ethub.io, and follow us on Twitter at econoar and at sassel0x.